but difficult of solution, was the initiator, the minuscule innermost component of the bombs. The chain reaction required a neutron or two to start it off. No one wanted to trust $1 billion worth of uranium or several hundred million dollars worth of plutonium to spontaneous fission, or a passing cosmic ray. Neutron sources had been familiar laboratory devices for more than a decade, ever since James Chadwick bombarded beryllium with alpha particles from polonium and broke the elusive neutral particle free in the first place. In his early lectures at Los Alamos, Robert Serber had discussed using a radium-beryllium source in a gun bomb, with the radium attached to one piece of core material and the beryllium to the other, arranged to smash together when the gun was fired and the two core components mated to complete a critical assembly. Radium released dangerous quantities of gamma radiation, however, and Edward Condon noted in the Los Alamos Primer that some other source, such as polonium, will probably prove more satisfactory. Polonium emitted copious quantities of alpha particles, energetic enough to knock neutrons from beryllium, but very little gamma radiation. The challenge of initiator development was to design a source of sufficient neutron intensity that released those neutrons only at the precise moment they were needed to initiate the chain reaction. In the case of the uranium gun, that requirement would be relatively easy to meet, since the alpha source and the beryllium could be separated with the bullet and the target core. But the implosion bomb offered no such convenient arrangement for separation and for mixing. Polonium and beryllium had to be intimately conjoined in Fat Man at the center of the plutonium core, but inert as far as neutrons were concerned, until the fraction of a microsecond when the imploding shockwave squeezed the plutonium to maximum density. Then the two materials needed instantaneously to mix. Polonium, element 84 on the periodic table, was a strange metal. Marie and Pierre Curie had isolated it by hand from pitchblende residues at backbreaking concentrations of 0.1 milligram per ton of ore in 1898, and named it in honor of Marie Curie's native Poland. Physically and chemically, it resembled bismuth, the next element down the periodic table, except that it was a softer metal and emitted 5,000 times as much alpha radiation as an equivalent mass of radium, which caused the ionized, excited air around a pure sample to glow with an unearthly blue light. PO210, the isotope of polonium that interested Los Alamos, decayed to lead-206 with the emission of an alpha particle and a half-life of 138.4 days. The range of PO210's alphas was some 38 millimeters in air, but only a few hundredths of a millimeter in solid metals. The alphas gave up their energies ionizing atoms along the way and finally came to a stop. That meant the polonium for an initiator could be safely confined within a sandwich of metal foils. Sandwiching the foils, in turn, might be concentric shells of light, silvery beryllium. The entire unit need be no larger than a hazelnut. I think I probably had the first idea for an initiator design, Bethe remembers, and Fermi had a different idea, and I thought mine was better for once, and then I was the chairman of a committee of three to watch the development of the initiator. Segregating the PO210 from the beryllium was straightforward. Making sure the two elements mixed thoroughly at the right instant was not. And the primary difference between initiator designs, many were invented and tested during the winter of 1944-45, was their differing mixing mechanisms. A quantity of PO210 equivalent in alpha activity to 32 grams of radium, thoroughly mixed with beryllium, would produce some 95 million neutrons per second. But that would be no more than 9 or 10 neutrons in the brief 10 millionth of a second when they would be useful in an imploding Fat Man to start the chain reaction. Therefore, the mixing had to be certain and thorough. Initiator design has never been declassified, but irregularities machined into the beryllium outer surface that induced turbulence in the imploding shockwave probably did the job. The Fat Man initiator may have been dimpled like a golf ball. To supply 10 neutrons to initiate a chain reaction, men labored for years. Bertrand Goldschmidt, a French chemist who had once been Marie Curie's personal assistant and who came to the United States after the invasion of France to work with Glenn Seaborg at the Met Lab, extracted the first half curie of initiator polonium from old radon capsules at a New York cancer hospital. Polonium is a daughter product of radium decay. Quantity production required using scarce neutrons from the Oak Ridge air-cooled pile to transmute bismuth one step up the periodic table to PO. Charles A. Thomas, research director for the Monsanto Chemical Company, a consultant on chemistry and metallurgy, took responsibility for purifying the PO, for which purpose he borrowed the indoor tennis court on his mother-in-law's large and securely isolated estate in Dayton, Ohio, and converted it to a laboratory. Thomas shipped the PO on platinum foil in sealed containers. But another nasty characteristic of polonium caused shipping troubles. For reasons never satisfactorily explained by experiment, the metal migrates from place to place and can quickly contaminate large areas. This isotope has been observed to migrate upstream against a current of air, notes a post-war British report on polonium, and to translocate under conditions where it would appear to be doing so of its own accord. Chemists at Los Alamos learned to look for it embedded in the walls of shipping containers when Thomas's foils came up short. Initiator studies proceeded in G Division at a test site established in Sandia Canyon, one mesa south of the hill. The initiator group drilled blind holes in large turbine ball bearings, screwballs, the experimenters called them, inserted test initiators, and plugged the holes with bolts. After imploding the screwballs, they recovered the remains and examined them to see how well the PO and BE had mixed. Mixing, unfortunately, could not be a conclusive measure of effectiveness. Bethe's committee selected the most promising design on May 1, 1945. But only a full-scale test, culminating in a chain reaction, could prove definitively that the design worked. Progress toward a Japanese atomic bomb, never rapid, slowed to frustration and futility across the middle years of the Pacific War. After the Imperial Navy had bowed out of atomic energy research, Yoshio Nishina had continued patriotically to pursue it, even though he privately believed that Japan, in challenging the United States, had invited certain disaster. On July 2, 1943, Nishina had met with his army liaison, a Major General Nobuuji, to report that he had great expectations for success. He noted that the Air Force had asked him to study uranium as a possible aircraft fuel, as an explosive, and as a source of power. And he had recently received a request for assistance from another army laboratory, which had contributed 2,000 yen to his expenses. Nobuuji promptly discouraged such consultations. "The main point," Nishina agreed, "is to complete the project as rapidly as possible." His calculations, he told Nobuuji, indicated that 10 kilograms of U-235 of at least 50% purity should make a bomb, although cyclotron experiments would be necessary to determine whether 10 kilograms will be sufficient or whether it will require 20 kilograms or even 50 kilograms. He wanted help finishing his 60-inch cyclotron. "The 250-ton, 1.5-meter accelerator is ready for operation, except for certain components, which are unavailable, as they are being used in the construction of munitions. If this accelerator is completed, we believe we can accomplish a great deal. At this moment, the U.S. plans to construct an accelerator 10 times as great, but we are unsure as to whether they can accomplish this." The previous March, Nishina had discarded as impractical under wartime conditions in Japan all methods of isotope separation except gaseous thermal diffusion. Otto Frisch had tried gaseous thermal diffusion, differing from Philip Abelson's liquid thermal diffusion, at Birmingham early in 1941, and proved it inadequate for separating uranium isotopes. But Nishina had no knowledge of that secret work. The Riken team had designed a thermal column much like the laboratory-scale column Abelson had built at the Naval Research Laboratory in Washington, of concentric 17-foot pipes, the inner pipe heated to 750 Fahrenheit, electrically heated in the Riken configuration, and the outer pipe cooled with water. Nishina did not meet again with Nobuuji until 7 months later, in February 1944, when he reported difficulty producing uranium hexafluoride. His team had managed to develop a method for generating elemental fluorine, but had not yet been able to combine the gas with uranium using an old and inefficient process that Abelson in the United States had discarded before he began his thermal diffusion studies. Nishina also had a problem with his diffusion column that Abelson would have appreciated. It leaked. To achieve an airtight system, Nishina told Nobuuji, we used sealing wax and finally achieved our goal. Solder could not be used because of the corrosive properties of the fluorine. He was in the middle of developing this hexafluoride-generating process, but can see the end in sight. His 1.5-meter cyclotron was now in operation, but only at low energy. His explanation for that compromise comments pointedly on the condition of the Japanese industrial economy by 1944. We have been unable to obtain any superior high-frequency generating vacuum tubes for the cyclotron. As a result of this constraint, the low operating voltages limit the population of neutrons we can produce. In order to liberate many high-energy neutrons, a high-voltage vacuum tube is required, but unfortunately, they are difficult to acquire. By summer, Nishina's group had manufactured some 170 grams of uranium hexafluoride. In the United States, hex was now being produced by the ton, and in July attempted a first thermal separation. Gauges at the top and bottom of the column, intended to measure a difference in pressure, showing that separation was taking place, indicated no difference at all. Well, don't worry, Nishina told his team. Just keep on with it. Just keep giving it more gas. He reconvened with Nobuuji on November 17, 1944, to report that, since February of this year, there has not been a great deal of progress. He was losing as much as half his hexafluoride to corrosion effects. We thought the materials we had used to make this apparatus for working with the hexafluoride were made of impure metals. Therefore, we next used the most highly refined metals available for the system. However, they were still eaten away. It was therefore necessary to reduce the pressure of the system to compensate for this erosion. The cyclotron was operating at higher but not yet full power. Nishina was using it, he told Nobuuji, to assay the concentrated, separated material. Significantly missing from the November 17th conference report is any mention of measurable separation of U-235 from U-238. Nishina's staff had understood for more than a year that he did not believe his country could build an atomic bomb in time to affect the outcome of the war. Whether he continued research out of loyalty, or because he thought such knowledge would be valuable after the war, or to win support for his laboratory and deferment from military service for his young men, the bare record does not reveal. On the occasion of the November 17th conference, he once again complained of the lack of sufficiently powerful vacuum tubes for his cyclotron, and told Nobuuji, contrary to the evidence of experiment, that the Riken's efforts at isotope separation were now at a midpoint in their practical solution. Nobuuji might have been more helpful if he had understood even the most basic facts of the work. An exchange between the two men late in the meeting indicates the military liaison was as innocent of nuclear physics as a stone. Nobuuji, if uranium is to be used as an explosive, 10 kilograms is required. Why not use 10 kilograms of a conventional explosive? Nishina, that's nonsense. A B-29, specially modified, first dropped an atomic bomb, a dummy thin man, at Muroc Army Air Force Base in California on March 3, 1944. Restrained by sway bracing, the bomb hung singly in the B-29's bomb bay from a single release. And the first series of tests ended ignominiously that season when a release cable loosened and dumped one onto closed bomb bay doors at 24,000 feet. The doors were then opened, a technical report notes, and the bomb tore free, considerably damaging the doors. A second series of tests in June went better. Word that Fat Man would be heavier than previously estimated encouraged Norman Ramsey's delivery group to replace the original bomb release mechanism, which had been modified from a standard glider tow release, with a sturdier British Lancaster bomber design. Lessons learned, the Air Force began modifying 17 more B-29s at the Glenn L. Martin plant in Omaha, Nebraska, in August. That month, the service prepared to train a special group to deliver the first atomic bombs. The 393rd Bombardment Squadron, then based at Fairmount, Nebraska, in training for Europe, would form the nucleus of the new organization. Late in August, Henry H. Happ Arnold, the commanding general of the U.S. Army Air Forces, approved the assignment of an Illinois-born lieutenant colonel, Paul W. Tibbetts, 29 years old, to be group commander. Tibbetts may well have been the best bomber pilot in the Air Force. He had led the first B-17 bombing mission from England to Europe, had carried Dwight Eisenhower to his Gibraltar command post before the invasion of North Africa, and had led the first bomber strike of that invasion. More recently, he had been test piloting the B-29, which in 1944 was just beginning to come online, working with the physics department at the University of New Mexico in Albuquerque to determine how well the new bomber could defend itself against fighter attack at high altitude. He was a man of medium height and stocky build, with dark, wavy hair and a widow's peak, full-faced and square-jawed, a pipe smoker. His father was a candy wholesaler in Florida and a disciplinarian, from whom Tibbetts probably acquired his reserved perfectionism. He was closer to his mother, the former Enola Gay Haggard of Glidden, Iowa. He had chosen an Air Force career, he told a post-war interviewer, after his mother had supported him in that choice against his father's opposition. "When I was in college, studying to be a doctor, I realized that I had always wanted to fly. In 1936, my desire to do something about it reached the point where a family showdown on the subject developed. During the discussion, a few tempers flared, but my mother never said a word. In the end, still undecided, I got her off to the side and asked her what she thought. Despite the things that had been said on the subject, and the fact that most of the people in the discussion had included the statement, 'You'll kill yourself in an airplane,' Mother said, quite calmly and with positive assurance, 'You go ahead and fly. You will be all right.' So far he had been, and now he had won a new assignment. He flew to 2nd Air Force Headquarters in Colorado Springs at the beginning of September 1944 to report to Commanding Major General Uzal Ent. An aide installed him in the general's anteroom. An officer came out, introduced himself, took Tibbetts aside, and asked him if he'd ever been arrested. Tibbetts considered the situation and decided to answer honestly to this stranger that he had been, as a teenager in North Miami Beach, caught in flagrante delicto in the back seat of a car with a girl. Lieutenant Colonel John Lansdale, Jr., who was responsible to Groves for atomic bomb intelligence and security, knew about the arrest and had questioned Tibbetts to test his honesty. Now he led him into Ent's office. Norman Ramsey and Deke Parsons were waiting there. "I'm satisfied," Lansdale said. The physicist and the Navy officer briefed Tibbetts on the Manhattan Project and the Muroc bombing tests. Lansdale cautioned him at length on security. After the three men left, Ent specified Tibbetts' assignment. "You have to put together an outfit and deliver this weapon," the pilot remembers the 2nd Air Force commander saying. "We don't know anything about it yet. We don't know what it can do. You got to mate it to the airplane and determine the tactics, the training, and the ballistics, everything. These are all parts of your problem. This thing is going to be very big. I believe it has the potential and possibility of ending the war." The delivery program within the Air Force had been codenamed Silverplate, Ent told him. If Tibbetts needed anything, he had only to use that magic word. Arnold had accorded it the highest priority in the service. The Air Force chose Wendover Field, Utah, as home base for the new organization. Tibbetts flew to Utah early in September, looked the base over, and liked what he saw. It was sighted between low mountain ranges, on the desert salt flats in gritty and secure isolation 125 miles west of Salt Lake City, near the Utah-Nevada border. The flat basin, the sink of an ancient and enormous freshwater lake, of which the Great Salt Lake is a brackish remnant, offered miles of desolation for bombing practice. Pioneers bound for California had suffered the crossing once. Their wagon ruts could still be viewed nearby. The 393rd moved to Wendover in September, and with the addition of troop carrier and other support components, became the 509th Composite Group. In October, it began receiving its new B-29s. A Boeing product, the B-29 was a revolutionary aircraft, the first intercontinental bomber. It was conceived in the late 1930s by ambitious officers within what was then still the Army Air Corps, as the vehicle of their vision of wars fought at great distance by strategic air power. As early as September 1939, they proposed its use from bases in the Philippines, Siberia, or the Aleutians in the event of war against Japan. It was the world's first pressurized bomber, and at 70,000 pounds, the heaviest production bomber ever built, 135,000 pounds loaded. A weight that required an 8,000-foot runway to lumber airborne. In appearance, it was a sleek, polished aluminum tube 99 feet long, intersected by huge 141-foot wings. Two B-29s would fill a football field, with a classical sinusoidal tail nearly three stories tall. Four Wright 18-cylinder radial engines that each developed 2,200 horsepower propelled it at altitude at 350 miles per hour maximum speed. It cruised at 220, and it was designed to fly a 4,000-mile mission with up to 20,000 pounds of bombs, though 12,000 pounds was nearer its operational load. It could cruise above 30,000 feet, out of range of flak and most enemy fighters. Turbo superchargers boosted engine power. Outsized 16.5-foot propellers turned more slowly than those of any other aircraft. Wing flaps, the world's largest, adjusted a fifth of wing area to adapt the high-speed, long-range, low-drag wing for takeoff and landing. On the ground, the B-29 rested level on three-point landing gear, retractable wheels at the nose and under each wing. The plane's 11-man crew occupied two pressurized sections within the five joined sections of the fuselage. Tandem bomb bays fore and aft of the wings separated the nose section from the waist and tail, and to pass back from the nose to the waist required crawling through an unpressurized one-man tunnel. The standard B-29 crew counted pilot, co-pilot, bombardier, flight engineer, navigator, and radio operator in the nose section. Three gunners, and a radar operator in the waist, and another gunner in the tail. Because electrical wiring was less vulnerable to battle damage than pneumatic or hydraulic tubing, the aircraft systems, with the exception of the hydraulic wheel brakes, operated entirely on electric motors, more than 150 in all, with a gasoline-powered donkey engine in the rear fuselage supplying current on the ground. Analog computers ran a central gun control system, but all the guns were stripped from the 509th bombers, except the 20-millimeter cannon in the tail. If the B-29's engines were powerful, they were also notoriously susceptible to fires. To improve their horsepower-to-weight ratio, Wright had used magnesium for their crankcases and accessory housings. Engine cooling was inadequate, and exhaust valves tended to overheat and stick. An engine would then sometimes swallow a valve and catch fire. If the fire reached the magnesium, a metal commonly used in incendiary bombs, the engine would usually burn through the main wing spar and peel off the wing. To prevent such disasters, Boeing improved engine cooling, but the basic design fault persisted. There was no time to develop a new power plant if the aircraft was to serve the war for which it was invented. One delivery group physicist remembers skimming along at Wendover for miles after takeoff, mowing sagebrush to cool the engines before climbing to altitude. Once at altitude, the flight crews of the 509th practice bombing runs. Bombardiers aiming from above 30,000 feet through their Norden bomb sights at progressively smaller target circles limed on the ground. Crews that had flown in cloudy Europe wondered why they were training in visual bombing. An odd evasive maneuver instructed them at least in the explosive potential of the unknown weapon they would carry. Tibbetts briefed no one on the atomic bomb, but directed his crews to nose their aircraft over into a sharp 155-degree diving turn immediately after bomb release. Diving, the huge bombers rapidly increased their airspeed. By perfecting the maneuver, the crews could escape 10 miles from the delayed explosion, safe from destruction by a bomb of 20,000 tons TNT equivalent, writes Groves, by a factor of 2. Before they practice their diving turns, they drop bombs of concrete and bombs filled with HE. These crudely riveted Fat Man imitations, painted bright orange for visibility, they called pumpkins. The 509th worked hard. The winter wind howled over the Wendover Reservation, trapping tumbleweeds on the barbed wire fences. Crews careened into Salt Lake City on weekends to blow out. Tibbetts opened their mail, bugged their telephones, had them followed, and shipped off those who broke security to the secure but miserable Aleutians for the duration of the war. He held authority over 225 officers and 1,542 enlisted men. With his silver-plated requisitions, he commandeered from around the world the best pilots, bombardiers, navigators, and flight engineers he could find. One of them, Captain Robert Lewis of Brooklyn, New York, stocky and blonde, 26 years old, an abrasive but gifted pilot whom Tibbetts had personally trained, had spent part of the summer of 1944 at Grand Island, Nebraska, teaching a senior officer with hundreds of combat hours behind him to fly B-29s. Thus checked out, Major General Curtis LeMay rode a C-54 to India late in August to take over the 20th Bomber Command, based in India, with forward airfields in China, from which it was attempting, with fewer than 200 B-29s, to bomb Japan. The bombers had to ferry their own fuel and ordnance from India to China over the Himalayas before each mission. 7 supply flights for each bombing strike, up to 12 gallons burned for each 1 gallon delivered. It didn't work, LeMay writes in his autobiography. No one could have made it work. It was founded on an utterly absurd logistic basis. Nevertheless, our entire nation howled like a pack of wolves for an attack on the Japanese homeland. Curtis LeMay was a wild man, hard-driving and tough, a bomber pilot, a big game hunter, a chewer of cigars, dark, fleshy, smart. "I'll tell you what war is about," he once said bluntly, but he said it after the war. "You gotta kill people, and when you've killed enough, they stop fighting." Through most of the war, he seems to have held to the preference for precision bombing over area bombing that had distinguished the U.S. Air Force from the British since Churchill's and Cherwell's intervention of 1942. Sometimes, in Europe, precision bombing had served, though never decisively. Over Japan, so far, it had failed. And failure was LeMay's bête noire. His father had been a failure, an odd-job drifter, forever moving his family around. The LeMays lived all over Ohio, in Pennsylvania, out in the wilds in Montana, in California. Curtis Emerson LeMay, born in Columbus, Ohio in 1906, was the first of 7 children. The 2 memories of early childhood he chooses to offer in his autobiography are linked, of first seeing an airplane and chasing it madly. I wanted not only the substance of the mysterious object, not only that part I could have touched with my hands. I wished also in vague yet unforgettable fashion for the drive and speed and energy of the creature. And of compulsively running away from home. Truancy that bordered on mania, his mother told him. I had to grow older, LeMay writes, and be burdened with a lot of responsibilities and begin to nourish ambition. I had to do these things before I could manage to control my temper and discipline my activities. He delivered telegrams and packages and boxes of candy. He delivered newspapers, sold newspapers, wholesale newspapers to delivery boys, supporting himself and sometimes his family. When the grocer hesitates about putting that latest basket of groceries on the bill, then you'd better be ready to come up with cash in hand. Very early in life, I was convinced bitterly of this necessity. The larder was a vague mystery, which Hop didn't bother to penetrate. LeMay resented the missing childhood, but moved on. He paid his own way through Ohio State by working nights at a steel foundry. ROTC in college led to the Ohio National Guard, because the Guard had higher priority on Army Flying School enrollments than the Army Reserve. He won his wings in 1929 and never looked back. Mess officer, navigation officer, general headquarters navigator, B-10s, B-17s. In England in 1943 and 1944, he worked night and day to improve precision bombing. He won quick promotion. Arnold sent him to the Pacific because he needed someone who could get the job done. General Arnold, fully committed to the B-29 program all along, crawled out on a dozen limbs about 1,000 times in order to achieve physical resources and sufficient funds to build those airplanes and get them into combat. So he finds they're not doing too well. He has to keep juggling missions and plans and people until the B-29s do well. General Arnold was absolutely determined to get results out of this weapon system. The B-29 had to be used, that is, successfully used, or men who had staked their careers and their convictions would be shamed, resources squandered that might have aided elsewhere in the war, lives lost futilely and millions of dollars wasted. The justification recurs. The first B-29 to arrive in the Marianas landed on Saipan on October 12, 1944. Brigadier General Haywood S. Hansel, Jr., assigned to lead the 21st Bomber Command, flew it. As Arnold's chief of staff, Hansel had helped formulate the doctrine of precision bombing and believed strongly in its central premise, that wars could be won by selectively destroying the enemy's key industries of war. A stream of new bombers followed the new commander out to the Marianas. The first U.S. aircraft to fly over Tokyo since the Doolittle Raid of 1942 was a B-29 on November 1st, soaring high and light on a photo reconnaissance mission. A French journalist living in Tokyo at the time, Robert Julien, remembers his sense of anticlimax. The city waited. Millions of lives were suspended in the silence of the radiant autumn afternoon. For a moment, anti-aircraft fire shook the horizon with a noise of doors slamming in the sky. Then, nothing. The all-clear was sounded without a sight of the plane. The radio announced that a single B-29 had flown over the capital without dropping any bombs. That seemed a reprieve, and for a time only reconnaissance missions disturbed the ill-defended city. One day, the visitor finally appeared, flying at 35,000 feet, Guyane continues. He even left his signature chalked on the sky, a line of pure white, like some living thing that seemed to nose an almost imperceptible silver fly ahead of it. Back in the Marianas, Hansel was teaching his men to navigate together, to fly in formation. They had trained in the United States only as individual crews. Hansel received his first target directive on November 11th. The Joint Chiefs of Staff had approved it, and it reflected their conviction that bombing and naval blockade alone could not bring the Pacific War to a timely end. In September, the combined chiefs, British and American together, had established a planning date for the end of the war, 18 months after the defeat of Germany. The U.S. Joint Chiefs judged an invasion of the Japanese home islands essential to achieve that goal. The target directive Hansel received, therefore, gave first priority to the precision bombing of the Japanese aircraft industry to cripple Japanese air defenses before an American invasion. Second priority to supporting Pacific operations. MacArthur was even then reoccupying the Philippines, returning as he had promised he would. And third priority to testing the efficacy of area incendiary attacks. These priorities, putting precision bombing first, suited Hansel's own. His crews flew their first raid on Japan from Saipan on November 24th. Their target was the Musashi Aircraft Engine Factory north of Tokyo, 10 miles from the Imperial Palace. 100 planes began the mission. 17 aborted. 6 were unable to release their bombs. Flak was heavy, and the target buried in undercast. But totally unexpected at the high altitude at which the bombers flew was a 140-mile-per-hour wind. They were blown with it over the target, and their ground speed was therefore nearly 450 miles per hour, impossible for the bombardiers. As a result, only 24 planes managed to bomb the factory area. The rest scattered their loads over the docks and warehouses around Tokyo Bay, and only 16 bombs hit the target. "I did not anticipate the extremely high wind velocities above 30,000 feet," Hansel said later, "and they came as a very disagreeable surprise." The Air Force had discovered the jet stream. LeMay was then still working with his 20th Bomber Command out of India and China. Supporting the indifferent military campaigns of Chiang Kai-shek was an activity he abhorred, but was sometimes forced to perform. For 6 months, Claire Chennault, the leathery Texan who headed the U.S. Air Staff assigned to the Nationalist Chinese Army, had been promoting the bombing of Hankou, the riverside city on the Yangtze, 500 miles inland from Shanghai, from which Japan supplied its Asian mainland army. With a renewed Japanese drive in interior China in November, Chennault pressed for a Hankou attack. LeMay resisted diverting his command from Japanese home island targets. The Joint Chiefs had to compel his participation. B-24s and B-25s were also massing for the strike. Chennault particularly wanted LeMay to load his aircraft with incendiaries and bomb from 20,000 feet rather than from above 30,000 feet in order to sow a denser pattern. LeMay reserved one aircraft in five for high explosives. 77 B-29s took part in the raid on December 18th and burned the Hankou River District down. Fires raged out of control for 3 days. The lesson was not lost on Washington, nor on LeMay. At Los Alamos, the same week, Groves, Parsons, Conant, Oppenheimer, Kistakowski, Ramsey, and several other leaders met in Oppenheimer's office to discuss preparing pumpkins, they called them blockbusters, for Tibbetts' 509th Composite Group. The first Fat Man design, the 1222, had already been changed because it had proved so difficult to assemble. Assembly required inserting, threading nuts onto, and tightening more than 1,500 bolts. And redesign meant the loss of about 80% of the tooling work done at the Pacific Aviation Company in Los Angeles through the autumn. The first unit of a new, simpler design, the 1291, would be ready in 3 days, on December 22nd. Captain Parsons said that the blockbuster production for the 1291 gadget between 15 February and 15 March would require a minimum of 30 blockbusters, the minutes of the meeting report, so that each B-29 could drop at least two. An additional 20 blockbusters should be produced for HE testing. Following that, 75 units should be produced for overseas shipment. Groves wanted none of it. He wanted no dummy 1291s drop-tested outside the continental United States, and he saw no reason to build 75 pumpkins for overseas target practice for Tibbetts' crew. It was the end of 1944, and he was feeling the pressure of accumulating Manhattan Project delays. General Groves indicated that too much valuable time was being taken from other problems to devote time to the blockbuster program. Conant asked how long the blockbuster program would have to continue. Parsons answered combatively that it would have to continue as long as Tibbetts' group operated, so that 509th crews could maintain their bombing skills. He relented to reveal that Colonel Tibbetts' group expected to reach peak combat training by 1 July. Since Parsons had not succeeded in person in convincing Groves of the importance of bomb assembly and bombing practice, he wrote the general a forceful memorandum on the day after Christmas. There were major differences, he pointed out, between the gun gadget and the implosion gadget, particularly in terms of final assembly. "It is believed fair to compare the assembly of the gun gadget to the normal field assembly of a torpedo, as far as mechanical tests are involved. The case of the implosion gadget is very different, and is believed comparable in complexity to rebuilding an airplane in the field." Even this does not fully express the difficulty, since much of the assembly involves bare blocks of high explosives and in all probability will end with the securing in position of at least 32 boosters and detonators, and then connecting these to firing circuits, including special coaxial cables and high-voltage condenser circuit. I believe that anyone familiar with advanced base operations would agree that this is the most complex and involved operation which has ever been attempted outside of a combined laboratory and ammunition depot. Parsons' simple and compelling point: the assembly team, as well as the bombardiers, needed practice. Groves relented. Tibbetts got his pumpkins. More conventional bombs were falling regularly now on Japan, if not yet to devastating effect. Robert Guyenne, the French journalist, remembers the first night raid over Tokyo at the end of November. Suddenly, there was an odd rhythmic buzzing that filled the night with a deep, powerful pulsation and made my whole house vibrate. The marvelous sound of the B-29s passing invisibly through a nearby corner of sky, pursued by the barking of anti-aircraft fire. I went up on my terrace roof. The B-29s, caught in the sweeping searchlight beams, went tranquilly on their way, followed by the red flashes of AK-AK bursts, which could not reach them at that altitude. A pink light spreading across the horizon behind a near hill, growing bigger, bloodying the whole sky. Other red splotches lit up like nebulas elsewhere on the horizon. It was soon to be a familiar sight. Feudal Tokyo was called Edo, and the people there had always been terrified by the frequent accidental fires they euphemistically called Flowers of Edo. That night, all Tokyo began to blossom. While Parsons and Groves were debating pumpkins, Loris Norstad, who had succeeded Hansel in Washington as Hap Arnold's chief of staff when Hansel moved to the Marianas, passed along word to his predecessor that a trial fire raid on Nagoya, Japan's third largest city, was an urgent requirement. Hansel resisted. "With great difficulty," he wrote Norstad, "he had implanted the principle that our mission is the destruction of primary targets by sustained and determined attacks using precision bombing methods, both visual and radar, and he was beginning to get results. Ironically, he feared that area bombing would slacken his crew's hard-won skills." Norstad sympathized, but insisted that Nagoya was only a test, a special requirement resulting from the necessity of future planning. Nearly 100 of Hansel's B-29s flew incendiaries to Nagoya, at the southern end of the Nobi Plain, 200 miles southwest of Tokyo, on January 3, 1945, and started numerous small fires that resisted coalescing. In 3 months of hard flying, taking regular losses, Hansel had managed to destroy none of his 9 high-priority targets. His determination not to rise to the bait Washington was offering, Billy Mitchell, the Air Force's earliest strategic champion, had pointed out the vulnerability of Japanese cities to fire as long ago as 1924, doomed his command. Norstad flew out to Guam to relieve Hansel of duty on January 6th. Curtis LeMay arrived from China the next day. "LeMay is an operator," Norstad told Hansel. "The rest of us are planners. That's all there is to it." As if to encourage the new commander to independence, Hap Arnold suffered a major heart attack on January 15th and withdrew for a time to Miami Sunshine to heal. LeMay officially took command on January 20th. He had 345 B-29s in the Marianas and more arriving. He had 5,800 officers and 46,000 enlisted men. And he had all Hansel's problems to solve: the jet stream, the terrible Japanese weather, 7 days of visual bombing a month with luck and not much weather prediction because the Soviets refused to cooperate from Siberia, whence the weather came. B-29 engines that overheated and burned out while straining up the long climb to altitude. Indifferent bombing. General Arnold needed results. Larry Norstad had made that very plain. In effect, he had said, "You go ahead and get results with the B-29. If you don't get results, you'll be fired. If you don't get results also, there'll never be any strategic air forces of the Pacific. If you don't get results, it will mean eventually a mass amphibious invasion of Japan to cost probably 500,000 more American lives. LeMay set his crews to intensive training. They were beginning to get radar units, and he saw to it that they were able at least to identify the transition from water to land. He ordered high-altitude precision strikes, but experimented with firebombing as well. 159 tons on Kobe on February 3rd burned out 1,000 buildings. Not good enough. Another month of indifferent operation, LeMay calls February. When I summed it all up, I realized that we had not accomplished very much during those 6 or 7 weeks. We were still going in too high, still running into those big jet stream winds upstairs. Weather was almost always bad. I sat up nights, fine-tooth combing all the pictures we had of every target which we had attacked or scouted. I examined intelligence reports as well. Did actually very much in the way of low-altitude flak exist up there in Japan? I just couldn't find it. There was food for thought in this. There was food for thought as well in two compelling February horrors. One occurred halfway around the world, in Europe, where LeMay had flown so often before. The other began nearby. The hard-bitten general from Ohio, who despised failure and was failing in Japan, could not have avoided learning in detail of both. The European event was the bombing of Dresden, the capital of the German state of Saxony, on the Elbe River, 110 miles south of Berlin. Famous for its art and its graceful and delicate architecture. In February 1945, the Russian front advanced to less than 80 miles to the east. Refugees streamed west from that deadly, harrowing, and into the Saxon city. Lacking significant war industry, Dresden had not been a bombing target before and was essentially undefended. It counted in its suburbs 26,000 Allied prisoners of war. Winston Churchill instigated the Dresden raid. The Secretary of State for Air responded to a phone call from the Prime Minister sometime in January with tactical proposals. The PM countered as testily as he had countered in the matter of Niels Bohr. "I did not ask you last night about plans for harrying the German retreat from Breslau. On the contrary, I asked whether Berlin, and no doubt other large cities in East Germany, should not now be considered especially attractive targets. I am glad that this is under consideration. Pray report to me tomorrow what is going to be done." Dresden's number thus came up. On the cold night of February 13th, 1,400 Bomber Command aircraft dropped high explosives and nearly 650,000 incendiaries on the city. 6 planes were lost. The firestorm that ensued was visible 200 miles away. The next day, just after noon, 1,350 American heavy bombers flew over to attack the railroad marshaling yards with high explosives, but found 9/10 cover of cloud and smoke and bombed a far larger area, encountering no flak at all. The American novelist Kurt Vonnegut Jr. was a young prisoner of war in Dresden at the time of the attack. He described his experience to an interviewer long after the war. "The first fancy city I'd ever seen, a city full of statues and zoos like Paris. We were living in a slaughterhouse in a nice new cement block hog barn. They put bunks and straw mattresses in the barn, and we went to work every morning as contract labor in a malt syrup factory. The syrup was for pregnant women. The damned sirens would go off, and we'd hear some other city getting it. Whump, 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 whump. We never expected to get it. There were very few air raid shelters in town, and no war industries. Just cigarette factories, hospitals, clarinet factories. Then a siren went off. It was February 13th, 1945, and we went down 2 stories under the pavement into a big meat locker. It was cool there, with cadavers hanging all around. When we came up, the city was gone. The attack didn't sound like a hell of a lot, either. Whomp. They went over with high explosives first to loosen things up, and then scattered incendiaries. They burnt the whole damn town down. Every day afterward, we walked into the city and dug into basements and shelters to get the corpses out as a sanitary measure. When we went into them, a typical shelter, an ordinary basement usually, looked like a streetcar full of people who'd simultaneously had heart failure. Just people sitting there in their chairs, all dead. A firestorm is an amazing thing. It doesn't occur in nature. It's fed by the tornadoes that occur in the midst of it, and there isn't a damn thing to breathe. We brought the dead out. They were loaded onto wagons and taken to parks, large open areas in the city which weren't filled with rubble. The Germans got funeral pyres going, burning the bodies to keep them from stinking and from spreading disease. 130,000 corpses were hidden underground. Nearer at hand, Curtis LeMay could see the intensity and ferocity of Japanese resistance increasing as American forces fought their way toward the home islands. The latest hellhole was Iwo Jima, Sulphur Island, a mass of volcanic ash and rock only 7 square miles in area, with a dormant volcano at one end, Mount Suribachi, that had risen from the sea within historic times. Miasmic with sulfur fumes, a steam of rotten eggs, Iwo lacked fresh water, but supported 2 airfields from which Japanese fighter bombers departed to attack LeMay's B-29 shining on their hardstands on Guam, Saipan, and Tinian. It was 900 miles closer to Tokyo than the Marianas, and its radar outposts gave Honshu anti-aircraft batteries and defensive fighter units ample warning when B-29s dispatched for strategic assault passed overhead. The Japanese understood the island's strategic position and had prepared for months, often under bombardment from U.S. Navy and Air Force planes, to defend it. 15,000 men turned Iwo Jima into a fortress of bunkers, ditches, trenches, 13,000 yards of tunnels, 5,000 pillboxes, and fortified cave entrances, vast galleys and wards built into Suribachi, blockhouses with thick concrete walls. The emplacements were armed with the largest concentration of artillery the Japanese had assembled anywhere up to that day. Coastal defense guns in concrete bunkers, field pieces of all calibers shielded in caves, rocket launchers, tanks buried in the sand up to their turrets, 675-pound spigot mortars, long-barreled anti-aircraft guns cranked down parallel to the ground. The Japanese commander, Lieutenant General Tadamichi Kuribayashi, taught his men a new strategy. "We would all like to die quickly and easily, but that would not inflict heavy casualties. We must fight from cover as long as we possibly can." His soldiers and Marines, increased in strength now to more than 21,000, would no longer throw away their lives in bonsai charges. They would resist to the death. "I am sorry to end my life here, fighting the United States of America," Kuribayashi wrote his wife, "but I want to defend this island as long as I can." He expected no rescue. They meant to make the conquest of Iwo so costly, says William Manchester, who fought not this battle but the next one, Okinawa, that the Americans would recoil from the thought of invading their homeland. Washington secretly considered sanitizing the island with artillery shells loaded with poison gas lobbed in by ships standing well offshore. The proposal reached the White House, but Roosevelt curtly vetoed it. It might have saved thousands of lives and hastened the surrender, arguments used to justify most of the mass slaughters of the Second World War, and neither the United States nor Japan had signed the Geneva Convention prohibiting such use. But Roosevelt presumably remembered the world outcry that had followed German introduction of poison gas in the First World War, and decided to leave the sanitizing of Iwo Jima to the U.S. Marines. They began landing on Saturday, February 19th at 9 a.m. after weeks of naval barrage and bombing. A less well-defended foe would have been pulverized by that battering. The Japanese dug in on Iwo Jima were only groggy from the long disturbance of their sleep. The Navy ferried the Marines to shore in Amphtrax, gave them over to the deep and treacherous black pumice of the beaches, and ran out to reload. The Japanese commanded Suribachi, the high ground. They had zeroed in on every point of consequence on the flat island and now stood back to fire. On the beaches, says Manchester, men were more often killed by artillery than by bullets. The invaders were taking heavy mortar and artillery fire. Steel sleeted down on them like the lash of a desert storm. By dusk, 2,420 of the 30,000 men on the beachhead were dead or wounded. The perimeter was only 4,000 yards long, 700 yards deep in the north and 1,000 yards in the south. It resembled Doré's illustrations of the Inferno. Essential cargo, ammo, rations, water was piled up in sprawling chaos, and gore, flesh, and bones were lying all about. The deaths on Iwo were extraordinarily violent. There seemed to be no clean wounds, just fragments of corpses. It reminded one battalion medical officer of a Bellevue dissecting room. Often, the only way to distinguish between Japanese and Marine dead was by the legs. Marines wore canvas leggings, and Nips khaki putties. Otherwise, identification was completely impossible. You tripped over strings of viscera 15 feet long, over bodies which had been cut in half at the waist. Legs and arms and heads bearing only necks lay 50 feet from the closest torsos. As night fell, the beach reeked with the stench of burning flesh. After that first awful night, when the Japanese might have squandered themselves in counterattacks but chose instead to hold fast to their defensive redoubts, the leaders of the invasion understood that they would pay with American lives for every foot of the island they captured. Kuribayashi's final order to his men demanded of them the same sacrifice. "We shall infiltrate into the midst of the enemy and annihilate them," he exhorted. "We shall grasp bombs, charge the enemy tanks, and destroy them. With every salvo, we will, without fail, kill the enemy. Each man will make it his duty to kill 10 of the enemy before dying." Slow, cruel fighting continued for most of a month. In the end, late in March, when shell fire had changed the very landscape, victory had caused 6,821 Marines killed and 21,865 wounded, of some 60,000 committed, a casualty ratio of 2-1, the highest in Marine Corps history. Of Japanese defenders, 20,000 died on Iwo Jima. Only 1,083 allowed themselves to be captured. That so many were dying to protect his B-29 crews, when their results were inconsequential to the war, catalyzed LeMay to radical departure. The deaths had to be justified, the debt of death repaid. One more incendiary test, 172 planes over Tokyo on February 23rd, produced the best results of any bombing so far. A full square mile of the city burned out. But LeMay had long known that fire would burn down Japan's wooden cities if properly set. Proper setting, not firebombing itself, was the problem he struggled to solve. He studied strike photographs. He reviewed intelligence reports. The Japanese just didn't seem to have those 20 and 40 millimeter anti-aircraft guns, he remembers realizing. That's the type of defense which must be used against bombers coming into attack at low or medium altitude. Up at 25 or 30,000 feet, they have to shoot at you with 80 or 90 millimeter stuff, or they're never going to knock you down. But 88 millimeter guns, if you come in low, are impotent. You're moving too fast. Low altitude firebombing had other important advantages. Flying low saved fuel coming and going from the Marianas. The B-29s could carry more bombs. Flying low put less strain on the big right engines. Fewer aircraft would have to abort or ditch. LeMay added in another variable and proposed to bomb at night. His intelligence sources indicated that Japanese fighters lacked airborne radar units. With little or no light flak or fighter cover, Tokyo would be nearly defenseless. Why not, then, LeMay reasoned, take out B-29 guns and gunners and further increase the bomb load? He decided to leave the tail gunner as an observer and pull the rest. He discussed his plan with only a few members of his staff. They worked out a target zone, a flat, densely crowded 12 square miles of workers' houses adjacent to the northeast corner of the Imperial Palace in central Tokyo. Even 2 decades after the war, LeMay felt the need to justify the site as in some sense industrial. All the people living around that Hattori factory where they make shell fuses, that's the way they disperse their industry. Little kids helping out at home, working all day. Little bits of kids. The U.S. Strategic Bombing Survey notes, frankly, that 87.4% of the target zone was residential. And LeMay goes on to more candid admission later in his autobiography. No matter how you slice it, you're going to kill an awful lot of civilians. Thousands and thousands. But if you don't destroy the Japanese industry, we're going to have to invade Japan. And how many Americans will be killed in an invasion of Japan? 500,000 seems to be the lowest estimate. Some say 1 million. We're at war with Japan. We were attacked by Japan. Do you want to kill Japanese? Or would you rather have Americans killed? A little later in the war, a spokesman for the 5th Air Force would point out that since the Japanese government was mobilizing civilians to resist invasion, the entire population of Japan is a proper military target. On to the proper military target of working-class Tokyo, LeMay decided to drop 2 kinds of incendiaries. His lead crews would carry M-47s, 100-pound oil gel bombs, 182 per aircraft, each of which was capable of starting a major fire. Behind those crews, his major force would sow M-69s, 6-pound gelled gasoline bombs, 1,520 per aircraft. He eschewed magnesium bombs because those more rigid weapons smashed all the way through the tile roofs and light wooden floors of Japanese houses and buried themselves ineffectually in the earth. LeMay also remembers including a few high explosives in the mix to demoralize the firemen. He delayed seeking approval of his plan until the day before the raid was scheduled to go, taking responsibility for it himself and determined to risk the gamble. Neustadt approved on March 8th and alerted the Air Force public relations staff to the possibility of an outstanding strike. Arnold was informed the same afternoon. LeMay's crews were stunned to hear they would fly their sorties unarmed at staggered levels between 5 and 7,000 feet. "You're going to deliver the biggest firecracker the Japanese have ever seen," LeMay told them. Some of them thought he was crazy and considered mutiny. Others cheered. From Guam first, from Saipan next, and then from Tinian, 334 B-29s took off for Tokyo in the late afternoon of March 9th. They were loaded with more than 2,000 tons of incendiaries. They flew toward a city that an Associated Press correspondent who knew it well had described in 1943 in a best-selling book as grim, drab, and grubby. Freed from Japanese detention in Manila and then in Shanghai, Russell Brines had brought home a message about the people he had lived among before the war and whose language he spoke. "We will fight," the Japanese say, "until we eat stones." The phrase is old. Now revived and ground deeply into Japanese consciousness by propagandists skilled in marshalling their sheep-like people. It means they will continue the war until